Synes jeg, at det måtte få givet. Good evening, everyone. We are reading from Srimad Bhagavad Gita. We are now in the 13th chapter. And the chapter title is Nature, the Enjoyer and Consciousness. And the text will be text 16, which is marked by the pictures that are falling out of the book. Okay, so first we will start with an invocation and we will go from there. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Bahirantascha Bhutanam. Bahirantascha Bhutanam. Acharang charamevacha. Acharang charamevacha. Sukshmatvat tad avijayam. Sukshmatvat tad avijayam. Durastang chantike chatat. Durastam chantike chatat. Bahirantascha bhutanam. Acharam charamevacha. Sukshmatvat tad avijayam. Durastam chantike chatat. Please repeat. Bahirantascha bhutanam. Acharam charamevacha. Sukshmatvat tad avijayam. Durastam chantike chatat. Bahirantascha bhutanam. Acharam charamevacha. Sukshmatvatara vijayam. Durastam chantike chatat. Word for word. Bahihi. Outside. Antaha. Inside. Cha. Also. Bhutanam. Of all living entities. Acharam. Not moving. Charam. Moving. Eva, also. Cha, and. Sukshmatvat, on account of being sattva. Tat, that. Avijayam, unknowable. Durastam, far away. Cha, also. Antike, near. Cha, and. Tat, that. Translation and purport by His Divine Grace Srila A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Srila Prabhupada Ki. The Supreme Truth exists outside and inside of all living beings, the moving and the non-moving. Because He is subtle, He is beyond the power of the material senses to see or to know. Although far, far away, He is also near to all. Purport. In Vedic literature, we understand that Narayana, the Supreme Person, is residing both outside and inside of every living entity. He is present in both the spiritual and material worlds. Although He is far, far away, still He is near to us. These are the statements of Vedic literature. Ashino durang rajati shayano yati sarvataha. This is from the Katha Upanishad 1.2.21. And because He is always engaged in transcendental bliss, we cannot understand how He is enjoying His full opulence. We cannot see or understand with these material senses Therefore, in the Vedic language, it is said that to understand him, our material mind and senses cannot act. But one who has purified his mind and senses by practicing Krishna consciousness in devotional service can see him constantly. It is confirmed in Brahma Samhita that the devotee who has developed love for the Supreme God can see him always without cessation. And it is confirmed in the Bhagavad Gita 11:54 that he can be seen and understood only by devotional service. Bhaktyat Tvanayaya Shakyaha. Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu Stabdamina Bhutale Swami Pramayam Vidatisvapatantikam. The translation again: the Supreme Truth exists outside and inside of all living beings, the moving and the non-moving. Because he is subtle, he is beyond the power of the material senses to see or to know. Although far, far away, he is also near to all. First class of the year, so happy new year, everyone. Of course, I think in the Vedic calendar, we've got a few more days, is it? Until the sun actually changes its course. Because in traditional calendars, they base it very strictly upon the planetary movements, and our Western calendar is now somewhere close. This verse is talking about the Supreme Personality of Godhead with some contradictions. He is both outside and inside. For most people, this is an easy contradiction. I hope it's easy. He's all-pervading. He doesn't have material limitations like we do, which means he can exist at a distant place and exist in present place. We have some experiences that we have telephones, we have internet communication, so we can spread our influence around with top technology. We're kind of used to that. We're beyond the smoke signals, but it's the same example. You know, we can project ourselves and we can experience things at different places, different times. So God naturally, as the Christian tradition says, we are cast in his image. Similarly, he can project himself anywhere he likes. And for the sake of all living entities, he has expanded himself individually in all of their hearts to assist them to be, as in Christian traditions they call the Holy Spirit. We use the term super soul, which is derived from the Sanskrit Paramatma, which is supreme self. We are that. Atman is the word for self, and jiva is the technical word for soul. So we as the self, as the Atman, or the jiva, as the soul, are with and accompanied by Paramatma, a supreme self. He's always there to guide us, like the good conscience in the background. And he's apparently always there to be heard, but we tend to ignore him or tend to fill our minds with other voices of other things, of different influences. You know, what is current in the media, what is current in our speculative ideals of the world that we've concocted by our own various philosophies. And we try to drown out what is the voice of God. Obviously that has its disadvantages, and we miss out on some guidance, but ultimately he guides us nonetheless by hook or by crook in some way, shape or form. And rather than ignoring our desires when we are ungodly, so to speak, or selfish in our motivations, what God does in this philosophy of the Bhagavad Gita is he fulfills our desires of any kind, but in this world he allows us to suffer the consequences via the process of karma. And karma also comes samsara, which is repeated reincarnation. So these are some basic doctrines of Bhagavad Gita and any philosophy that's based on it. So we are in a world of karma and of material laws, and God is in a world of spiritual elements created by which are composed of a substance known as Brahman. There's various schools. There are various schools of Vedanta philosophy, which is certain branch. Veda means knowledge and Anta means end. This is a branch in India of philosophy, and they deal with the end of all knowledge, the conclusion of all intelligible things. So within the Vedanta branch is the school of Vaishnavism that we are one part of, and then there is also Shankaracharya's Advaita Vad Advaita Vedanta, which is an impersonal monism where everything is one without variegation. And the idea of variegation and reality is an illusion in his philosophy. Our idea of Brahman, which is what the spiritual essence is, that he believes is an impersonal, immutable, singular thing, we believe is a eternal, variegated experience that is natural to our very self. And it's a very different philosophy, because where the ultimate conclusion is that you are ultimately not interacting, our ultimate conclusion is that we are interacting with this supreme being, God, and God's friends, other jivas, other souls, other beings. So it's like a collective, essentially, it's one in purpose, but varied in number of beings, and they all have their own lives. I mean, so what that basically means is, in Shankarite philosophy, you would detach yourself from your so-called self and surrender to a supreme one essential element. Whereas this is saying that you detach yourself from your material entanglement, your distraction from which is done by material things, and attach yourself to an even more variegated, more personal, more interacting existence. So rather than, that's why ultimately a lot of people who are, we use the term personalist, and we use impersonalist for a Shankarite philosophy. Rather than impersonalists going and being extreme ascetics like a Buddhist or some monk in a far distant land in the Himalayas and meditating in snow, we tend to interact with people, and we tend to have centers based on bringing people to interact with each other, because this is part of our essential nature. And we ultimately believe that you can, for a very, very, very long period of time, try to be one and alone, but eventually your soul will be frustrated, because you need love, you need interaction, you need people, or living things. So, but we also acknowledge that this material world is a distraction. So what does that mean? How do we perceive the spiritual? How do we get beyond this material thing? And the philosophy, the process that we prescribe, the process is called bhakti, which can be translated to devotion, an attitude of gratitude, to service, different things, to love. This is a very common but difficult word to translate from Sanskrit, but this is the process that we prescribe. And different to other processes, like those of the Shankara school, they will advise jnana, however you pronounce it, which means a process of acquiring essentially spiritual knowledge. And then from there you attain Brahman, which is then essentially something different to the process. But our process is bhakti, which is where you practice bhakti. You practice being in loving relationship with others on respectable levels. And then what you develop from bhakti is purified bhakti. As opposed to developing a separate goal, you develop the process itself, and it becomes more natural. Because ultimately we believe it is the natural thing that we are supposed to do. We've become a little distracted by material ideals. Now we're just reacquiring what we already knew. So ultimately, it is within ourselves. This process is not a foreign thing. There are some books that are considered holy Shastra, which is supposedly the voice of God who's trying to direct us back. But ultimately, it is within ourselves. And we're just trying to touch, as we said, touch with the Paramatma that is there next to us all the time, who's just kind of like, hello. The example, I think, which is also from the Katha Upanishad, it's from the Kena, maybe, is the birds in the tree. Is that the right Shastra I'm quoting, Madhu? Essentially, there is this analogy that there are two birds in the tree, and one bird is eating all the fruits of the tree, and the other bird is simply waiting for this other bird to ignore the fruits that are on the tree and pay attention to the other bird so they can have an interaction. So this example is God within the heart. It's to explain God within the heart. He's waiting for us to get bored of the typical day-to-day over and over our life that we saturate ourselves in, and look back at himself and have a relationship with him. And ultimately, it sounds pretty outrageous, but it's very natural. I mean, if it is your essential nature, then it shouldn't be too hard, really. If it is who we are, then it shouldn't be hard. If it's not, then it will be difficult. Or if we've been distracted for so long, it could also be difficult. But essentially, it should be easy to be yourself, which is actually what we're trying to say, is to be yourself. And hopefully, by asking you to be yourself, we're not telling you who you are. No, you should be yourself, and yourself, you will have your own relationship with God and with his creation, and you'll have your own conception. We hope with this philosophy that you get rid of the distractions, and essentially everyone will have in a supreme pure state a different concept of God. And that's a very esoteric fact, that you have your own individual relationship. It's not that you will become a robot in the clone war of humanity and you will convert all to the one doctrine and everyone will say the same thing and do the same thing. No, you will have a very unique individual relationship, and no one can take that away from you except for yourself, ultimately. And even that is a temporary thing. We want to get out of the temporary things, and we want to find the permanent thing, because anything that gives temporary happiness it may be, will go away. And anything that gives happiness temporarily will then give frustration, because then the happiness is removed. And we're essentially used to eternal things. That's why we get so frustrated when the car breaks down, so frustrated when our friendships break up, our marriages break up, our relationships break up, so frustrated when we get full when we're eating, or we run out of food, or anything like this. Any limitation frustrates us, because we are essentially eternal, and we are used to things lasting forever, you know. Nowadays, everything's just made in China, and it's made to break. You don't even repair things anymore. You get a warranty, and they don't send you something repaired, unless you're really lucky. They send you a brand new thing. So, you know, why don't they just give me two in the first place? So, this is how it is now. You know, we don't have... Well, this is how it always is. We don't have anything that lasts. At least in the old days, we kind of made things last a little longer. But we're essentially frustrated. And the biggest frustration of our life will be, ultimately, our life when we come to the point of death, because it will be the biggest frustration. Because no matter how hard we tried and no matter how many things we did, it wasn't enough, and it's all going to go away. For those who have experience in flying, you know, you come up to the check-in and you put your luggage on the scale. You're allowed 20 kgs. If you're lucky, it's 30. And if you're unlucky and you're flying on Ryanair or something, it's 15. And, you know, maybe the person at the counter will let you off a few kgs, or maybe they'll charge you 50 euros to get on that flight with your things. So when you come to the point of death, this is like you don't even get a carry-on, you know what I mean? You essentially have to take your clothes off and put them in a basket and walk through the metal detector. You're starting fresh, you know what I mean? Babies don't come out fully dressed, fully educated and ready to roll, you know? They start crying and they can't even walk, you know? And sometimes come out with complications, and fear, and it's a bloody mess. And then they come out and they, you know, you spend 20 years of education, if you're lucky, or 12 or whatever it may be, learn to walk and ride bicycles and start all over again. This is frustrating for anyone, really. You know, it's like every, you know, like when you go to bed at the end of a hard day and you expect to wake up and feel rejuvenated and you just wake up feeling tired again. And you gotta, you know, most people gotta find the coffee as soon as possible. It's like, this is frustrating for all of us. You know, we don't want to wake up and feel like we've got to start again. We want to wake up and feel like we're continued. Of course, we need some sleep so we don't go crazy, but we know we want to keep going. But we can't do that in this material world. It's just impossible. This place is just made, things are created, things sustained for some time, and then they dwindle. This is the nature of material world. This will be explained in other parts of the Gita, and this is essentially explained at the very beginning as well. We want spiritual. So the process it's saying, you can't perceive spiritual, obviously, with a limited material. So then you must attempt to follow that which you do in a spiritual environment, and that is developing relationships of love and appreciation, of respect. That's pretty easy. And understanding that you are not the center of the universe. You know, you have heliocentric, you have geocentric, you have all these doctrines of which planet revolves around what planet, but ultimately we think it's egocentric, you know, it just revolves around me. So doesn't mean you're not going to have fun if you just kind of take a step aside. You're going to still experience everything you need to experience, but perhaps you're not going to be the guy on the throne. And that's essentially what we've been made for, is to not be that guy. And when we try to be that guy, we are frustrated, you know. This is ultimately, in this philosophy, what our experiment is in this material world, is a God project. God is the supreme controller, and he is the supreme enjoyer. So we find things for two reasons. Can I control it, or can I enjoy it? Children, oh, so lovely. Or, you know, you will be a sports star like I wanted to be. You know, it's like essentially how we govern our lives. We find things to control and enjoy. We find members of the opposite sex, not because we want to give them everything because we're such nice, kind, generous people. No, because we want to control them or enjoy them. This is what we do. And you can look at your whole life now and be frustrated. Now you'll always see that you're constantly controlling and enjoying. But ultimately, our design as a soul is to be of some service. And doesn't mean that we're going to be slaves, but maybe if you like it. But, you know, it means that you provide some, you give out, you know. You don't just suck in. You're not like a leech on the world. And doesn't mean you go and, you know, you don't have to go feed the hungry in Africa. You have to give people something meaningful, something spiritual. If you go out and give people food packages, that's fine. That'll sustain them materially. But what's it going to do for them spiritually? If you help someone in their relationship, and I will stress spiritual relationship, and that sounds very cosmic and might sound a little bit indoctrinating, but if you go out and just give people like love without expecting it back, then you're doing what you're supposed to do, and you will find yourself very, very happy. If you do it too much, you might find yourself materially in poverty because you need to sustain your life, so you might have to find the balance, but you will find yourself very, very fulfilled. And I don't know too many people who don't. And if they do, I think they're very, very selfish and they need to work on themselves a little bit. So this is ultimately what the process is. You're giving love. You're giving relationship. You're being a person. You're not being a robot. So you could be yourself. You know, you can be angry from time to time if something's gone wrong, whatever. You can have feelings. You're entitled to your feelings and opinions. But you slowly filter out, like any water filter does, all the silt and all the disturbing elements that are not you, that have simply stuck to you. You're just kind of like a big thing of Velcro, and you just got all this lint all over you. So you're just essentially getting rid of that stuff. And therefore, it's very natural. And for me, I was born in this whole religious movement where we wear funny bed sheets and all these things. And all the externals look very, very confusing. And a little bit kind of alternative, kind of a bit hippie-ish. A little Indian, you know, nice little pointy things and shiny things and thrones and plates and things like that. And idol worship and all these godforsaken things. But it's been exceptionally easy. because it's very, very natural. I'm not brainwashed. Maybe I am, maybe that's why I say it, because I am. But I just have to be myself. And my ultimate instruction in life is to try to be more myself and try to understand who I am. And that's really cool, because it's just really refreshing to just try and like always figure out who you are. I mean, it's like, at least if you don't get all the way, you at least learn a little bit about yourself. So at least you kind of got somewhere, you know what I mean? And our philosophy is that, okay, whatever, because we have reincarnation, okay, so you come back as a fumbling little baby and you're crying, you've got nothing going on for you. But there are impressions that are sustained. And even now there's some little kind of scientific things going on where they're studying this, and some people believe it, some people are skeptical. But it looks pretty real. You can trace back people's families. This little kid is speaking about all these different people from or different languages or God knows what. So there are impressions that are sustained, and the majority of things are washed away, but spiritual impressions, they remain. And Krishna will address this at one point, because Arjuna will say, what if I fail? What if I don't make it? Because, you know, he doesn't want to be some kind of crazy yogi, some kind of crazy aesthetic in some jungle somewhere. And Krishna says, no problem. He says, you will be born in a family of enough wealth or enough spiritual knowledge that you can progress. And Krishna even says, because from me is text 15 of chapter 15, he says, from me comes remembrance, knowledge, and forgetfulness. And this means from this lifetime to the next. From him comes forgetfulness. We forget every time we die and come back, or just when we get older. And from him comes knowledge of, so you go, what do I do? What do I do? What do I do? He will tell you. You know, it's not going to be like you sit there and meditate and then there's going to be some voice that goes, hey, Brian, hey. No, it's going to be, you'll realize it. It'll come to you. You know, it'll probably blow your mind even more than some cosmic, you know, movie type scenario, because it'll be really real. You know, it won't be some dream, or maybe you'll have a dream. And then from him comes remembrance. So all the lessons you learned in so many lives, you know, okay, I already tried to enjoy this way. I already tried to do this. That didn't work for me. You know, I tried to be a male. I tried to be a female. I tried to be a donkey. It didn't work. So now I'm going to try this. You know, I'm going to try to develop myself spiritually. And actually, maybe I just tried that in my last lifetime and it was going well, and that's why I'm here. So these things come back to you. And I don't mean like, doesn't necessarily mean you have a clear, like, my name was Bob and I had a fire truck or all these things. That's not what we're talking about. That's a little bit far out. Maybe it happens to some people. I know I've heard some stories. But no, just like, you get the impression. The impression is all you need. You don't need all the little fiddly lines and all the details that don't help. They're just whatever. If you want to do that, go do a hypnosis session with some kind of transgression expert, which I will not recommend or not recommend. But we just work on what is in front of us. And ultimately, because this Paramatma, this Supreme Soul, is trying to get to us, he uses different versions. And these teachings here are now in lovely book form in English. But the funny script there is Devanagari, which is an Indian character alphabet. And it's designed around the language of Sanskrit. And Sanskrit is, for many scholars, the oldest language in the world. Other scholars will say Proto-Indo-European, and I will say that's baloney, because I've never seen it anywhere, and no one has either. But it makes really good sense in linguistic speculation. I hear we're studying a bachelor in religious theology, specializing in Vaishnavism. There's a small college here. We're accredited with the University of Chester. So that is my own opinion. That is not... but it is supported by some scholars and refuted by others, as everything is. This language is older than we can figure out, and we ultimately think it's an eternal language, and if it runs out of fashion, then there will always be someone to come and fix it up. And these books were once spoken texts that were remembered and recited, and even the greatest historians on this subject will say the spoken texts are probably the most preserved texts in the world, because they're not just spoken, they're na 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 na. They have like a whole meter, and they have these traditions where they just like teach people pure memorization of sound vibration, and they become very good at it, and it opens up some kind of passageway to their brain so their memory works really good. I'm not so cosmological, but it's just like they just robotically remember these books. For those who are a little less robotic and a little bit more philosophical to understand and appreciate. And from these books, we're collecting knowledge and we're using it. And we're thinking that if people have been trying to preserve it for thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands of years, that it's probably worth a little something. Because I don't see so many other things being preserved as well, except for maybe mummies in Egypt. Questions? Comments, accusations, criticisms, stones, tomatoes, etc. We have a winner. The example we quoted before was from the you got it there, okay. Oh, it's from that verse. Okay. So it's in the Gita, and then it's quoted in the commentary, and it's from the Mundaka and Sheshatara Upanishad. So it's from two different... Upanishads are very ancient books, and they're used often as authorized texts because they speak of the soul and the self and all these things. And they're very, very poetic and esoteric and very interesting. Okay. Anything else? Rarely. We've got 15 minutes to half an hour. We have a break, get some drinks. Ooh. Okay, the atomic individual soul. Look, we've got a picture that comes out now. We've got two pictures. So, for us, because the body dies and we get a new body. So ultimately, with use of our philosophical understanding, our natural intelligence, we should then conclude, if the body dies and we get a new body, then that means we're not the body. So this is like one of the very essential principles of the philosophy behind the Bhagavad Gita, which is why Krishna says, the second chapter is where Krishna starts his instructions, and particularly at verse 11, it kicks off. And then verse 12, Krishna, he recites the doctrine of reincarnation. He throws it in there right at the start. And I'm getting to it right now. Dehinas min ta dehe komaram yovanam jara tata dehantara pakti diras tatra namuyati. As the embodied soul continually passes in this body from boyhood to youth to old age, the soul similarly passes into another body at death. A sober person is not bewildered by such a change. So we're saying you are a being and you're made of your subtle, like whatever you feel as your consciousness, you know, however you permeate your nervous system, this is you. And then you're going from one place to the next. And we talk about it as an atomic spark, kind of like this little small guy. Essentially, the size doesn't matter because you're of spiritual nature, but you kind of shrink down into this little kind of dude. And like I was saying, the Paramatma, the Supreme Self, he is God and he's there with you. And so then there is many discussions of our relationship with that Supreme God. Are we one with him? Are we separate from him? Are we somewhere in between? What is our relationship? Are we him? So that's why I was explaining before, we have the Shankara philosophy where we are all just one. And by one, I mean no him, no her, no nothing. No attributes. Because their argument is attributes are bad, therefore no attributes is good. Whereas our argument is material attributes are bad, therefore spiritual attributes are good. So rather than just flipping it opposite and getting really, really confused about our non-existence or semi-non-existence, we go, okay, our existence is more. And then we have our philosophy comes under the line of achintya bheda abheda tattva, which means, achintya means an inconceivable thing. So we're talking now inconceivably. Beta means, chincha beta. Beta means different. And a beta, a cancels. So opposite. A beta, not different. So inconceivably different and not different. Tattva, which means truth or some kind of philosophy. So we are inconceivably one with and different to God, is what we're saying. And other things related to God. So we have essentially the same quality, but we are different in quantity, we are minute, and we have essentially a relationship with him as opposed to just being him and being some supreme robot. Yes, is this clear or is this confusing, Madhu? And Madhvacharya, who is a very, if you want to get into the Vedantic gurus, he's up there, he's from about 1,000 years ago. He will say, his doctrine is Dvaita. Dvaita, and Madhva is famous for doing the peace sign, he invented it. No, he does this, he's two. Dvaita means two. Essentially, two is not the number, I mean, everything is separate. And he will say that we are separate from God. And God is separate from the world, and we are separate from the world, and the world is separate from other parts of the world, and we are separate from other people. But he says these things, yet ultimately his conclusion is the same. We have a relationship with all beings and all things, and we depend and we have a relationship with God. Ramanujacharya. These guys, I mean, I'm just throwing them off and they just sound like random people, but they're actually very important people in Indian philosophy. And if you mention their names, I guarantee at least 95 of any Hindu should understand what you're saying. If not, they don't read. But Ramanujacharya, who's a little bit... He's Shankara came, then Ramanujacharya, then Madhva. This is how they are, between 1,000 or more. 2,000 years ago. So Ramanujacharya, his doctrine is in the middle, and he says Vishishta Dvaita. Vishishta, that means purified, and qualified. So qualified. A Dvaita, Dvaita means two, so A means not two. Make sure I close the right thing. Qualified oneness, because as I said before, Shankaracharya is Advaita, not two, just one. And it's not qualified. It's just one. What was it? One. Whereas Ramanujacharya, he is saying it is, yes, it is one, but it is qualified. And that means, yes, we are all part of God, but we still interact as parts with the whole. We still have a relationship like this hand has with my body. This hand serves my body. So we are essentially the same, but we are also essentially somewhat different. And again, his conclusion is we have a relationship with each other and we have a relationship with God and we serve each other and we help each other. So Shankaracharya's philosophy does not, because we are just one. But Ramanujacharya of qualified oneness, we do. Madhvacharya's dual, we also do. So although philosophically they are massively different, essentially their conclusion will be the same. So we appreciate them and we respect them as authorities, and their philosophies are analyzed and exemplified within our own. And the one I explained before, achintya bheda bheda tattva, simultaneously one and different, is the philosophy that Chaitanya Mahaprabhu introduced approximately 500 years ago. For us, he is an incarnation of God. For me, in my mind, when I say 500 years ago and then I say God, it sounds ridiculous, so I understand if it does. Apologize. But that's what we essentially believe. And others will essentially believe he is a saint. It's kind of like the Jesus, is he God or not kind of problem. But yeah, he gave this doctrine of the Chincha Beta Beta Tattva, or his close disciple Jiva Goswami, who he gave responsibility of to delegate the philosophy, did. Have to check that one. But yeah, it basically comes from... because what he essentially does is he comes, all the philosophies before him, he tries to show what is correct and what is incorrect with them, and then repropagate the philosophy for eternity, so to speak, or for the rest of however long it takes for this world to crumble and burn and then rise itself from the ashes. Without saying too apocalyptic. And you said, what was the second one? Nature is an atomic self, and then the position of this. Did I cover that in that a little bit? And yeah, in this, in the body, if you want to locate yourself, we say you're naturally, I am here. Your body, when you say, who am I? You go to the heart, there you are, pat yourself on the head. But that is essentially where all the energy is coming from, that permeates your body, spiritual energy. So I'm very, but that's what it is. And I think, as far as I know, Buddhism, they will say there is no self. Who else? And some others, obviously some atheistic philosophy will say there is no self. The body is the body, and that is everything, and then you will die. You are simply a combination of chemicals, interacting with a combination of chemicals, which sounds sad and boring and has a lot of flaws. Of course, any philosophy has flaws, but... I apologize for speaking fast. I'm from Australia. We're not known for being understandable or tipping very well at a restaurant. Okay. Grantraj Srimad Bhagavad Gita Ki Jai.